Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live Tastes of Better event held in Ascot in April 2024. Now, in this session, our panel looks to the future, predicting how food trends will change between now and the year 2030. They cover cost, sustainability, and personalised nutrition. Your host is Head of Product Innovation at Camden BRI, Mike Adams.
So we're here this morning to talk about food trends 2030, and what the future looks like. So everyone's been on the panel has been gazing into their crystal balls in preparation for this morning's panel. So really talking about what could be driving what consumers are going to be buying and how they're going to be engaging with the food and drink industry, you know, over the next 5-10 years. So we've got an amazing panel this morning. So I'm very quickly going to hand over to them and let them introduce themselves. And really, what are the top 2 or 3 trends coming down the line that you think are going to have the biggest influence? And that could be on consumer behavior, buying, or products, so things like taste. So, Millie.
Hi, I'm Millie Diamond, and I'm a strategist at WGSN, and we're a trend forecasting agency. And I work solely on the food and drink side of things. I'm going to go for 2 big ones that I think are key. One is water. We're seeing real problems with water. Drought is affecting the entire world, and we are seeing consumers adopting more and more water-conscious diets. So that might be waterless drinks. It might be drought-friendly crops in their products, in their snacks. And the other topic that I think is key is what we're calling at WGSN the Say Eat Gap, which is the disparity between what people think is important to them, like sustainability and animal welfare, and what they can actually afford and what they can actually find on the shelves that meets those needs. And at the moment, there's a huge gap between those two things.
That's really interesting. Yeah, the attainability of what people want, I think, is a really interesting point that's not often talked about, because a lot of these things come with costs, and not everyone can afford to eat the diet they want to eat. That's really interesting. Thanks, Millie. And Rich?
Good morning. My name is Richard Nish, and I am Global Futures for IFF. Global Futures sounds a little bit funny. I effectively look after our trend and foresight framework, and then apply that with both internally and with our customers. So we're looking at the short, the mid, and the long-term future of the landscape that we all operate in. So we're looking from a societal level, up through a people level, and to the top, to the market level, to see how things are changing. I think I'll choose 3. The first one I want to mention, we call simple frugality. It's around affordability, which is a huge issue for everyone at the moment, but it's more than just the affordability side. People are not only short of money, they're short of time. So they're looking for things that are simple, that are convenient, as well as affordable. So you've certainly got people who are looking for the cheapest product they can buy, but you've also got people who are trying to balance things off. So balance off the time and the money resource. And they're looking for products that are not necessarily the cheapest price, but give them the best value. So we call it values with value. The second one is we term better being, and this is how the health and wellness trend is progressing. So we're seeing some nuances in the way things are happening at the moment. Obviously, the mental health side has been developing at a rapid rate. So consumers now equate mental health, you know, at a level that is equal to physical health. We've seen a difference in approach to healthy aging and longevity. We've seen different groups come to the fore, so especially female health at the moment is getting a lot of attention. And consumers are looking for hard fact and scientific evidence to back up the claims of products as well. And the third one I want to talk about we call neo-hedonism. And if you think about affordability and health as a negative side, neo-hedonism is the fun side. But it's pushed from the fear, the anxiety, and the unhappiness that we see at a societal level. So if you think of the geopolitical situation, the economic situation, and so on, consumers are looking for escape in the products that they choose. So this idea of neo-hedonism, it's fun, it's indulgence, but it's not hedonism of the past. So for instance, the Roaring Twenties. I like to call it hedonism in a box. So it is, it's fun, it's indulgence, but it's contained. So you're not going to go out and buy a Ferrari. You're probably going to sit and have a nice cup of coffee in the sun. Slightly different in terms of hedonism.
Really interesting points, Rich. And the point about the changes in the kind of nutrition and health market around that requirement for hard science, you know, that anyone who's worked in that area looking at claims will know how difficult it is to talk to consumers about what a product can and can't do. And we're seeing more and more imaginative ways of getting around some of the restrictions in Europe. But no, really interesting points. Thank you. And Robert.
Hello, I'm Robert Lawson. I'm the managing partner at Food Strategy Associates. We are a leading strategy consultancy working solely in the food and beverage industry across Europe. I began my career actually in the food industry and was strategy director at a number of food companies. Most recently at Quorn, but not that recently. I've been in consulting quite a while. What are my three trends to talk about? First of all, plant-based isn't dead. There's been a lot of talk about the decline. We've gone through peak. We believe that the fundamental drivers of plant-based food are with us and with us for a very long time. So environment, animal welfare, and health were the drivers, remain the drivers. What's happened in the past couple of years is really issues around affordability. To pick up on what Rich was saying, consumer confidence has collapsed across the developed world. And as consumer confidence comes back, we do expect to see plant-based food returning strongly, albeit there are issues around taste and to a lesser extent, and I do mean to a lesser extent, around ingredient. So we think plant-based will be back with a bang. Secondly, perhaps a slightly different view on trends, but something that has emerged in the food industry, which wasn't there 10 years ago, is that there is now a huge amount of money invested with venture capital funds who are now entirely focused on food and sustainability. And 10 years ago, there was no such thing really as a food-focused venture capital fund. And now there are billions of dollars, euros, and to a lesser extent, pounds invested in venture capital. And they've had a volatile time over the past few years because what they've discovered is that food tech isn't the same as other techs, that it isn't infinitely expandable at no cost, and they can lose a lot of money. And so they've invested in things like Beyond Meat and then lost their shirt. But there's still a huge amount of money in venture capital, and it will be funding a lot of innovation and product development in the food industry. But they're going to be more focused on profit than they have been in the past. And I think, in a sense, that's an interesting trend. It's not clear how it will play out, but profit is going to be back in fashion for small emerging companies. And thirdly, just like to focus on a couple of technologies which I think are going to transform the industry, precision fermentation and biomass fermentation. I think we are going to be hearing more and more about these technologies, but not necessarily in the ways that we are being led to believe. I don't think we're going to be seeing any cheese made out of precision fermented casein in the foreseeable, because really around issues of affordability. So those were my three thoughts.
Excellent, thanks Robert. And I think that focus on the technologies, I mean, we're seeing a lot of news in precision fermentation, and a lot of it kind of tallies with the venture capitalists, you know, the so-called tech bros in kind of the West Coast of America have a huge amount of money and they all want to revolutionise the food industry. And then there's some, you know, there's quite a high failure rate, but there's some really interesting things happening in kind of the, you know, Silicon Valley and surrounding in the food industry, which, you know, for 20 years has not been a particularly interesting part of the food industry. But as you say, lots of money tends to do interesting things. So, yeah, no, it's going to be interesting to see which of those venture capitalist firms really hits the nail, because they've got the money to really, you know, bet on the right on the winning horse if they get it right. So,
can I just jump in?
You please do. Yeah.
On the precision fermentation, completely agree with you. And the areas that I think are really interesting that we're seeing coming to the fore now are things like infant formula, where you're getting breast milk replicas made with precision fermentation, which are giving a far better product than previously available. Also in the sports nutrition space, we're seeing a lot more development there, and also with edible beauty for things like collagen replicas. So I think those are the areas where you're going to see a lot more products starting to come out. There's companies like Turtle Tree that have just developed their product called LF Plus, which is a lactoferrin protein, and that's on the market now. So I think those are the areas to watch.
Connect.
Please do.
Jump in as well. Look, I think technology is the only way to deliver some of the aspects that consumers want. So if you think about the health aspects, the affordability aspects, the sustainability aspects, technology and use of technology and precision fermentation and so on is really the only way, or probably the best way, to deliver that. But at the same time, you've got this tension for consumers because they see it as highly processed food, and consumers are wanting more and more naturalness. So I think companies have got to be really careful in the way that they put the technology across. So there's a lot of communication needed around it for consumers to accept that, because they want natural, they want clean label, they don't want processed food.
So. Yes, yeah, so I mean, that was a point I was going to make, is I was slightly surprised none of you talked about what, certainly from the clients that I speak to at Camden BRI, is one of the trends that probably has them looking over their shoulder the most is ultra-processed food. Which is one of those subjects which is very emotive, but the more you look into it and the more you ask technical or scientific questions of, the harder it is to actually find an answer.
That's probably why we didn't.
We had a discussion before and it was like, well, there's not even really a definition that we can...
Well, I wasn't here for that discussion, so I'm more than happy to ask the question. And, you know, to talk about, you know, new technologies, you know, consumers are often scared of new technologies because they don't understand it. You know, so you talked a little bit about that with precision fermentation. Are there other trends or other things coming down the line, do you think, that battle for kind of the hearts and minds of consumers is going to be difficult? Because it's so new, consumers might be scared of it.
So precision fermentation is interesting in the sense that you can, in theory, make any ingredient and design completely new ingredients. We think one of the constraints is it's really expensive, and that's why I am highly sceptical that it will replace casein in cheese. But replacing applications in baby formula are very high value applications, and therefore there's a market. Applications in flavorings and colorants, also very expensive, and therefore there could be an opportunity. If we wanted to replace the dairy herd, the capital cost to do that will be about $5 to $10 trillion. So it's not going to happen in the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. Sorry, investors, in precision fermentation. The other technology that is getting a lot of talk is cultivated meat. And what is really striking there is I haven't really met cultivated meat players who have done any consumer research with consumers to say, well, how do you feel about eating pork slurry, which costs you 5 times the price of a sausage? I would expect that there is very little appetite for low quality meat at extraordinarily high prices. I may be wrong, but we shall see. So I think these technologies will have applications in small volume niche areas, and they're replicating already complicated unknown ingredients, or they're delivering a superior benefit in the case of formula, which is why they will overcome some resistance from consumers.
I think the whole cell-grown space is interesting, but it's the yuck factor for consumers. You know, it's so hard to get across that yuck factor. And I really don't see any way in the short, medium term to overcome that.
I was just going to say, I went to a particularly interesting dinner a couple of weeks ago where a company has started to make a new kind of protein from chicken feathers. So it's a bit like nose-to-tail eating with a pig. We're all used to that, whether you like it or not. Chicken feathers, there's like 2.3 million tons of waste chicken feathers every year in the EU. And those feathers are 90% keratin protein. So this guy is extracting the keratin protein from these chicken feathers to make a new meat sauce. It was nice. It just tasted like any other analog meat product. But how do you convince a consumer to eat feathers? It's a big ask. It seems disgusting. And I think it's explaining to consumers and having other angles that will draw them in, like the sustainability angle, like the cost angle, that is going to win them over. And from a lot of the research that we've done, if the consumer understands the process, they're a lot more likely to want to eat the product. But the consumer understanding still isn't there at the moment with the cultivated meat and the precision fermentation. They just don't understand what these processes are. And it's not widely available. So unless you're really into it, you're not going to go out searching for it.
No. So we've talked a lot about some of the challenges facing these new technologies. But, you know, on the flip side, there's some huge opportunities out there. So, you know, whether it's the technologies we've discussed already or on other trends coming down the line, you know, what are your kind of top picks for, you know, the huge opportunities or the next big wins coming down in, you know, in by 2030 or beyond?
I think any technology that allows the upcycling of material. I don't want to do an IFF cell job, but, you know, we've got a technology that will take the shells of spent cocoa and upcycle that into a flavour. So I think anything that takes that waste material and turns it into something useful for consumers from that sustainability perspective, but also from a cost perspective, you know, is a big winner.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think it goes back to my previous point about water. Anywhere that people can upcycle or reuse products to create more water is key. So I saw a product that's just launched in the last couple of weeks called Banana Water. It's using the banana skins from bananas that are already used for one process, and they're literally harvesting the water from these skins. So it's a waste process. It's also a single ingredient product, so it's full transparency, the entire process, the entire supply chain. I think that's going to be really key.
I would say the winner is taste and price, which is something that one might have said 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Technology that doesn't deliver taste or price or both is irrelevant. The technology which I am perhaps most personally vested in and interested in is the technology which makes corn, or similar technologies which are biomass fermentation, where you can upcycle waste products. So increasingly they're using low-grade potatoes or low-grade carrots, or not corn, but new technologies. So there is an upcycle element to it. But fundamentally, precision biomass fermentation can create a highly nutritious ingredient with almost zero taste, which leaves room for IFF to deliver some taste. I'll expect a plug later myself. But zero taste and at low cost and incredibly nutritious and environmental. So biomass fermentation could be used as an ingredient in making bread to add nutrition and replace carbohydrates. Could be used as a meat substitute, as it has been in the past, could be used in sports nutrition. Lots of applications for these ingredients, lots of emerging mushroom and fungi species developed to serve this market.
Excellent. Thanks, Robert. And I one thing we see in some of the work and consumer research that we commission on behalf of our clients is the huge disparity between the generations in the market. You know, we're kind of seeing the beginning of the end of the boomer generation. We have Gen X, you know, kind of leading the way. Millennials, obviously becoming, you know, starting families. And then Zs and Ys, you know, getting more and more buying power. How are we seeing that affecting the market? Because, you know, my 21-year-old niece is a very different consumer to my, you know, 41-year-old sister. You know, how is that going to affect the trends going forward, whether it's the acceptance of some of these new technologies you've talked about or completely different reactions to what before would be kind of traditional tactics in order to sell products?
Can I jump in? Yeah. So I think it feeds into what we both said earlier, which is that you were talking about values for value.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we say the say eat gap. And Gen Z is the first generation that has seen food become really politicized. And they have been told that they need to buy according to their values, but they just can't. So whether it's animal welfare, whether it's sustainability, whether it's inclusivity, they aren't able to buy those products. And the more that you are able to provide that for them, the happier they're going to be, essentially, because they're really dispirited at the moment. They're trying their best, their mental health's terrible, and this is making them feel even more miserable. And if you look at companies like Pop-Up Grocer in the States and you go on their product directory, you can filter by all kinds of different areas. So it could be queer-owned, it could be BIPOC-owned. There's all these different areas of inclusivity that they're catering to. And this is what people want available to them. They want to be able to pick and choose politically where their food's coming from.
Yeah, I think those moral, social and ethical values that they have are certainly coming through strongly, but being pushed down because of affordability and things like that. But those values are then going across the other generations as well. So there's a huge influence from Gen Z in terms of the other generations around those values.
I have nothing to add.
Okay.
I would like to add then.
Please do.
I also think this generation, and probably millennials as well, snacking is obviously a big one. Everyone knows snacking has gone wild. And the way that people are eating is changing. So the traditional three meals a day is not necessarily a thing anymore, especially for the younger generations. They're having smaller meals as snacks, they're having dips, even their dinner parties are not big formal affairs like our parents used to have. That everyone brings a little dip and some crisps, and that is a dinner party. It's not, you've got to have this whole three-course meal. So you've got to find ways to cater to those different requirements and create these meals that also are snackable occasions.
I think the other thing around the generations is the opportunities around older consumers. You know, if I think the age I am now, 20 years back, I thought that was really old. And the way that people are looking at aging now is quite different. So you've got a lot of older consumers who are very active and want to continue to be active. So there's a lot of opportunity around older consumers from targeting that health and well-being piece for them. So that's also, you know, cascading down to the younger consumers. And when I mentioned better being before, you know, this idea of longevity and healthy aging. So different generations are now using that and looking at what they need to do to be healthy at an older age range.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, the buying power, you know, there's that generational wealth gap between kind of the boomers and older Gen Xers who maybe got into the property market or have a good pension. That, you know, the younger generations don't just have yet. And I know in past lives working in the for manufacturers, you know, boomer women was kind of the great, you know, market because of their importance in the home and you know, they were the ones that put things on the shopping lists and bought them in supermarkets. But how do we sell products to old people? Because, or the aging population, sorry, is probably a little bit more politically correct, because you can't advertise it as this is for the aging population, because people will say, I'm not old, I'm not as old as that person on the advert, you know. And I think that, you know, and that's a great example, but it's also true for other markets as well, where you're targeting a very specific consumer, but the consumers don't recognize themselves as part of that cohort how do you overcome that challenge?
I think you focus on the active part and you position it in the right way. And if you, I'm sure Millie has a lot of good examples because there's a lot of good examples on WGSN. But you know, you've got brands who are targeting, for instance, pickleball. You know, huge growth in pickleball amongst older consumers. So you've got drinks that are targeting pickleball players with the electrolytes and vitamins and minerals that they need. So I think targeting as an active consumer, not targeting the age piece.
I definitely agree with that. And I think also we've seen the rise of functional food and drink, and we've seen it target stress, and we've seen it target mental health. And now we're seeing it even more niche, where it's targeting eye care and macular degeneration, or it's targeting organ function, or it's targeting bone density. And so those are the kinds of things that when you're in your 20s, you're not thinking about. But if you're in your 60s or your 70s, you might be slightly more concerned. So those are the products that you're more likely to reach for. So I think...
No, it's a great point.
So the other thing is, I mentioned before about, you know, a lot of targeting of female health. So you're seeing a lot of menopausal targets at the moment. So, you know, dealing with the 48 symptoms of menopause. And things like that are now becoming much easier to talk about. And it's dealing with the symptoms in a positive way, not kind of in a negative way, if that makes sense.
No, I think...
I was just going to add in the ability to target consumers directly and tightly allows for much, much more efficient spend. And the ability to access through channels which are not traditional channels also allows for more effective distribution. So I think the challenges are really, you know, they're not difficult challenges to overcome. The infrastructure is more there today than it has ever been before.
That really interesting point, Robert, just to touch on, is the shift of from via selling via traditional channels, supermarkets, etc., to the direct to consumer, and we're seeing more and more food brands selling through their own websites because that logistics back end is there for anyone to use. You know, is that something that you see continuing to grow and seeing more and more traditional food manufacturers, kind of people like Heinz and Unilever, are now selling direct to consumer? Is that something you see the growth in, or do you think that's something that the supermarkets will catch up with and make it not good business?
Well, I think the traditional food manufacturers are a little slow here. I think there are food categories which are substantially online and barely present in the supermarket. And here I'm thinking of, for example, sports nutrition is a huge category, almost undocumented in terms of data terms, because most of it is being sold online and there is no data available. And so nobody really quite has an idea exactly how big it is. And it's effectively targeting consumers for whom it relates. And of course you can pick up your sports nutrition bar in the supermarket, but you're more likely to get it online. So is it growing? Absolutely, it's growing, and much of the innovation is that is in the market is no longer in the supermarket.
No. I think the other thing that allows is personalization, and you know, that personalization piece within, especially health and wellness, you know, and fueled by AI and so on. You know, the advances we've seen in the last 6-12 months, and I think that's just going to speed up and allow, and consumers want that personalization around it as well.
Yeah, I mean, personalization is something that you kind of has been touched on in a number of the kind of comments, but not expressly as kind of the traditional topic of personalized nutrition, which, if this was 5 years ago when we were doing this panel, would probably be the number one thing we were talking about. And it's kind of, it's come and it's gone. And I think, you know, probably the biggest player at the moment, certainly in terms of you see them the most mentioned, is Zoe. Yeah, exactly.
The biggest area for this is pet food.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
We've just forecast that for pet food.
We're more interested in personalising the nutrition of our dog than we are of ourselves. And Tails has really developed that, and other players are in the market. In Germany, there's a cereal business. I've forgotten its name, but you order your specific muesli mix. It comes in a personalised pack. It requires huge investment in the manufacturing at setup to establish that, as well as website. But I think personalization is a trend that hasn't reached its potential, but I think pet food is where it's really working.
I think when you think of that fur baby side, we've seen huge focus on it in the last couple of years, and even to the point I noticed the number of hotels and so on that will not only allow pets in, but are actually welcoming and targeting those consumers. That's a huge shift.
Yeah, well, it's great business. It's a huge market that for years has, they've been sat outside on the picnic benches because they've not been allowed in with their dog.
Yeah.
So, really clever bit of marketing there for the hospitality industry. Millie, anything to add in?
No, I agree.
I think it's been very well answered. But I think Zoe's a really interesting company because it's at that kind of crossroads of the AI that you talked about, Rich, and they've just launched obviously the first kind of SKUs into M&S from the food perspective as well. And it's that you can eat something and then supposedly, I don't know, I haven't looked into the science too much, supposedly see exactly the effect it has on your body. I know there's some scepticism from some quarters as to the science behind it, but it certainly seems to be doing well. But just one final kind of call to arms. So preparing for the future, you're sat there with a client. What's the one thing that they need to think about? So if you had a message for this the room of luminaries we have here and from the food and drink industry, what's the one thing that you want them to think about when they get up and go for a cup of coffee after the session?
For me, the thing that brings it all together is the idea of value with values. So, if you can deliver the health values, the ethical values, the sustainability values that consumers want at a reasonable price, not necessarily the cheapest price, but a reasonable price, incorporating that value with values, I think that's where you want to target.
Robert?
I'm going to be simpler. Just value. For the next few years, value.
Yeah. No, I think that's the value is certainly a big buzzword we're hearing in the industry now. It's and know what it means to your consumers, because value means different things to different people.
I'm going to go rogue. I'm going to give you something that's going to give you something to think about, which is nocturnal living. The world is heating up. More and more countries are opening up activities at nighttime, like the beaches in Dubai are open for night swimming. There's night hiking, there's night golf. What products can you provide for people that are going to be shifting their routines? People are working remotely. They want to work at strange hours. They might want lighter and later meals. They might want things to help them sleep. They might want things to keep them going during the day or during the night, which is now their day. There's a lot of opportunities for nocturnal living, and the world's only going to keep getting hotter and more people are going to be more active at night.
So afternoon raves and night living.
Excellent. Right. Given the time, I think we will probably call it a day there. I'm sure the panel are around for at least the rest of the morning, if not into the afternoon. So if you do have any more questions for them, please do grab them when they're having a cup of coffee. And if you'd like to join me in thanking them for what's been a very insightful session.
Thank you for listening to that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, before we wrap up, we have some exciting news to share. Food Matters Live is returning this autumn with events in Ascot, Manchester, and for the first time, Dublin. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Whether you're looking to solve innovation challenges, explore positive nutrition trends, or learn strategies for sourcing sustainable ingredients, these events are designed for you. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com. We look forward to seeing you there.